And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
How's it going, Nick?
Doing good. Doing good. We've got another great show tonight. We're very, very lucky. We've got the director of photography, Ben Kosulke, on the show. And Ben is probably best known for his stylish and edgy collaborations with filmmakers Lynn Shelton and Guy Madden. He's shot numerous titles for them, including Touchy Feely, Your Sister's Sister, Hump Day, The Forbidden Room, Seances, and Kiel. Over the last 10 years, he's really become one of the premier visual talents working in the independent film world. He's worked on a variety of projects, stretching a number of genres with a number of different filmmakers. Other credits include Safety Not Guaranteed, The Freebie, and Treatment. And he's also been a contributor to television. And he worked on the first season of the FX show Married, which stars Judy Greer and Nat Faxon, which is a hilarious show. It's now in its second season. But he had the chance to work on that show, and it's I believe in its entirety, on the first season. And he's also a collaborator on Adult Swim's horror comedy The Heart She Holler with John Lee and Vernon Chapman, who also served as the creators of Wonder Chosen. And Ben has also worked on documentaries and short films. And one of his most recent projects is an upcoming Amazon series called Red Oaks, which is executive produced by Steven Soderbergh and directed by David Gordon Green, who worked on movies like Pineapple Express and Snow Angels. So it's an honor to have you on the show, Ben, and I look forward to finding all about your career and, you know, your background.
Well, thanks so much for having me, guys. This is great.
No problem, man. This is super exciting. We absolutely loved having Lynn Shelton on, and that was a total gush fest for us because we love her films, and particularly the visual style and the way they look. So I can't even wait to get into all that with you.
All right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Very exciting, it's hard not to love Lynn. She's amazing.
She's fantastic. So just right off the bat, how did you get your start in this, and what drew you to cinematography?
Yeah, well, you know, I did the film school thing. I went to Ithaca College, and I came from upstate New York, and I was sort of that weird era of film school student where I started and we were shooting on Super 16, and by the time I was out of there, we were finishing on Avid, and like there was no, you know, I started on flatbeds and ended digitally, and I was right at the cusp of, like, you know, I graduated in 99, so a decent prosumer 24 frame per second HD camera was still a long ways off, and so I kind of got the skills to shoot and to shoot celluloid in film school, and took that and kind of moved out west just to try out the Pacific Northwest, and I ended up in Olympia, Washington, and then Seattle, Washington, and around that time, there was just sort of like just the economy had sort of tanked, and people in the Northwest just didn't have a lot of money to make movies. The only people I knew that were able to get together any money for movies were fine artists that were getting grants. And the fine artists that were getting grants to make movies then were all, choreographers. And so there was this huge dance film scene in Seattle that was just really strange. I never ever would have thought that I would have ended up working as in dance film or in dance at all. I had no predetermined interest in it, but I started to meet a lot of people that were making local films in Seattle, and I was working as a negative cutter right out of college. And for 4.5 years, I cut film negative, and a lot of people that were making little tiny movies in Seattle needed their negative cut because there weren't video cameras around. So people started showing up at the negative cutting place I was working at, and they were real life people that were making real life movies and could afford to do it because they were getting grants, and they could afford to pay me a little bit of money to help them shoot things. And I knew how to shoot from college. And one thing sort of led to another, and I kind of became the guy that everybody referred to all of their friends that was shooting little like tiny dance films. And then the tiny dance films got longer, and then they turned into other projects. And then a few years down the road, those other projects became feature films.
Awesome. That's
kind of a weird non-standard route. You know, like I didn't plan on, I was like everybody else. I wanted to be a director when I went into film school. And then I ended up kind of falling into this niche sort of through timing and the economy tanking and just being able to work with a bunch of different people on the weekends. And shoot, like one thing led to another, I just found a niche shooting, and I really loved it.
And just so you know, we know, how did the, because I believe one of your first big credits was also Lynn's debut feature. Is that correct, Lynn Shelton?
Yeah, that was actually my second feature that I shot, but the first one that was completed. So I
completed. Yeah, because you've had multiple years with multiple projects released, which always begs the question, which got shot first and which was, you know, which took longer to edit. How did the relationship with Lynn get started?
Yeah, so, you know, Lynn was also sort of on the periphery of this dance film culture that was up in Seattle. There was a whole group of ladies that were making things. And Lynn, as she probably told you when she was on, was an editor.
Yep.
And she edited on the side. So she was cutting a lot of our mutual friends' films. And, like, I remember very specifically both Lynn and I showing up to videotape a performance from our friend Dana Hansen, who had a group called 33 Fainting Spells. They were sort of like a performance group. And I remember meeting Lynn very briefly, and then I didn't see her for about 3 years. And then I took a job. I was hired as an in-house cinematographer for sort of it was a bit of like an arts organization experiment. It was a non-profit film production company that was sort of built under a non-profit umbrella of the Northwest Film Forum. And Northwest Film Forum in Seattle is sort of a teaching and film screening nonprofit that you know, brings all the good indie art house stuff to town and also has classes that are affordable that teach people how to make movies. And in 2005, someone had put together a fund to hire a bunch of in-house film staff to make movies, to make feature films. And the idea was that we, as a group, would find artists that we loved and we would enable them to make a feature film. And the first feature film I did under that little umbrella as their cinematographer, I was sort of assigned to Guy Madden for Brand Upon the Brain, and we wrapped that film very quickly, and I went almost immediately into Lynn's movie. So Lynn's movie was the second feature I had shot under this organization called the Film Company, and it was the first one that was edited because Lynn was an editor and knew how to cut very quickly. And that was the first one that sort of did the festival route. I think she premiered in 2006, I believe, at Slam Dance, and she won at Slam Dance. And then right after that, the Guy Madden movie, Brand Upon the Brain, went to Berlin like 4 weeks later.
Yeah, and if people aren't familiar with Guy, because he's a very eclectic, you know, very independent-minded filmmaker, you should seek him out. Guy Madden is a Canadian filmmaker. His movies sort of defy description, any sort of traditional logline, typically. I think you'd probably agree they're very interesting, at times very bold formal expressions, which is one of the things I think is so unique about your work, is that you know, you've gotten a chance, from what we can tell and what we've seen, to really sort of get a chance to shoot a variety of different things. But one of the things I've always been able, you know, one of the things that always attracts me to somebody's work is when you can confidently move between two very distinct styles, and one being with Lynn, the sort of semi-improvised or sometimes fully improvised, fly on the wall, off the cuff style, and then something more formally, you know, experimental or surrealistic at times, certainly in something like Keyhole for a Guy. What's it like sort of, you know, jumping back and forth between various styles as a cameraman? You know, how do you approach the material as it comes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, for me, it's all very, it's refreshing. You know, I think if it was too much of the improvised, slightly more beautiful than realism, you know, non-scripted, actor-heavy model, it would be too much. And if it was, and if on the other end of the scale, if it was too much of the, you know, the Russian constructivist, German expressionist, black and white, everything serves the image and a texture, that might be too much as well. But to kind of move between the two of them and let either ends of that lever kind of inform the other end, it helps. It makes me feel sort of grounded, and it helps the sort of, you know, being a DP is a kind of, there's a great speed element to it, where you show up and you do like a lot of preparation, and then you shoot very intensely for a few weeks and work in these wonderful collaborative environments, and you make something really great in a few weeks, and then I can kind of move on. You know, like once the last round of dailies has come in, I don't really see the film again until there's rough cut screenings or even just when it's time to do the DI. And so there's something really refreshing that works for my personality in that, where I can kind of like touch and go a little bit. And that feeds into being able to jump between genres and being able to jump between styles. And so that's the sort of like the personal approach to it is just like, I love it. I embrace it. A good year for me is, you know, a foot in every type of pond. But the, you know, as far as the day to day, like, oh, we need to prep another film. Wait, I need to get my head out of Lynn Shelton, Mark Duplass world. I need to get into Guy Madden world or whatever. It's all fairly similar. It's just, you know, it's like you reignite a collaboration or you start a new collaboration and you just figure out what serves the story, what best serves the story and what you're, you know, the story that you're telling, what's universal about it, why does the world need to hear it, and what can you bring to that as far as the visuals go.
One thing I wanted to ask you is my favorite, I don't know if it's my favorite, well, I don't know, it's hard to say which my favorite Lynn Shelton film is, but Touchy Feely really struck me on so many different levels, and I was so excited when I knew I was going to get a chance to talk to you about it, because, you know, the way her films look are very inviting and they are very real world. And, you know, they don't take place in the cinematic universe that most films do. And when you brought up how you kind of switch gears between different filmmakers you work with or different styles, I felt that there was a moment in, Touchy Feely, the Ron Livingston scene
All Days of Heaven.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, that was straight up Malick.
Yeah, that was, and that's exactly. I remember thinking it through, and you know, I love that movie. I love it so much, and it's one of those ones that if you're looking at all of Lynn's movies, it's the trickier one to pick out of the bunch to throw at somebody and be like, watch this one. It's amazing. But it's amazing. It's like, I think it's her, and she probably will say this too. I feel like it's the most personal one. And you watch it and you're like, she needed to make this movie. Like it needed to happen.
Yeah.
There's an urgency to it that it's not conveyed in like speed or clumsiness. It's like there's an urgency to it and it needed to be articulated in a very specific way, and I think she totally nailed it. But what I truly love about that one is that at the very beginnings of it, at the script level, you could read that script, and not only did it feel like a Lynn movie, but like every seven or eight pages or so, there was something that was just pure visual poetics to it. And that was where it was really like, this is what I loved, you know, like I absolutely love every film I've done with her. But there was something built in to the structural idea of that movie that required us as storytellers to go purely, purely visual and purely audio and purely poetic and just to try and convey something that didn't need to be spelled out in the text. And I love that movie for that. Like it's one of my favorites of hers because, she just was thinking that way and she needed to think cinematically. And a lot of the emotions in that movie couldn't be spelled out with just people talking in a room, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, that scene is just breathtakingly beautiful.
Mm.
It's so fantastic, man.
Thank you. Yeah, it was that took a while to get right. There was a version of that was like a one-take, you know, attempt through two houses or two levels of a house and a bunch of rooms and... that was a tough day on our TJ Williams Jr. was our steady cam op. We don't usually get a lot of steady cam, but we had him for a day there and rough. I love that scene so much. It's beautiful.
And there's a big jump, you know, from the way that the, you know, like I, you know, quote unquote, the early Lynn Shelton movies to the, you know, to the more recent ones, because while you guys definitely continued on with the sort of fly on the wall style, the more grounded sort of approach to shooting stuff, there was sort of like the visual look and texture changed at a certain point, you know, from Hump Day into some of the other films. And was that something that you guys decided, you know, was that a digital versus a film type thing? Is that sort of how her, you know, how her and your aesthetic together sort of migrated? Because it's like, if you compare something like Laggies to something like, you know, My Effortless Brilliance, in the sense that you guys, the one thing I love about Lynn's movies, you could string them all up one after another, and they all feel like they're coming from the same cinematic world, the same voice. And they all feel sort of like they're connected. But the style that you guys have, you know, pioneered together, it's gradually gotten more finessed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty perceptive. I mean, Lynn and I, we talk about it a lot. Like, every time it's time to do a new movie, we have a little movie festival. We just, like, sit down and watch a ton of stuff. And we pull ideas from all the usual suspects. And there's, you know, there's the Malick stuff, and there's the Lynn Ramsey stuff, and there's the, you know, there's just, we tend to gravitate towards the same movies that we love, but inevitably we always come back to the same place of a cinematic world that is just a little bit on the dramatic side of reality. It should be cinematic and beautiful, but it should be grounded in real life. It should never, the world of the movie should never take away from the performance. And for everything we've done with her, from at least from My Effortless Brilliance onward, performance and actors have been paramount. You know, like making a place that's safe emotionally for people to perform and doesn't constrict them, and creating a set that removes the machinery of movie making so that we're in the realm of honest performance and complicated ideas being portrayed for the camera. That's sort of, we always come back to that. So it's like we know the world of Lynn Shelton's movies at this point. And that'll evolve over time, I'm sure, and that'll change over time. But I think that the change in texture and the change in sort of the delivery of that world is, I can say it's a few things, but two things in general. One is, you know, in My Effortless Brilliance, that was like a wonderful experiment, and it was a way to sort of, you know, we go way back, and it was a very traditional kind of 35 millimeter, your standard sort of American indie film that goes to a film festival. Like, there's a script, and there's a crew, and there's cameras that are big and loud, and there's lights, and people need to hit marks, and there's people pulling focus, and all the things that you think of when you think of a film set. And those are wonderful things for probably everyone involved except for the actors. And Lynn came from an acting background before she was an editor, and I think just saw the shortcomings of the machinery of filmmaking and how it could kind of corral a performance in a way that might not be helpful for the emotions you're trying to portray. So, you know, when it came time to do My Effortless Brilliance, we ended up in a situation where we were pulling off sort of an experiment where it was just Lynn and I, and maybe we would switch out a few light bulbs in a room, and each of us would grab a camera and just let Basil Harris and Sean Nelson and Calvin Reeder just kind of tear into the material. And it was, you know, it was a lot of talking, a lot of character development, and then just letting them dive into this situation that Lynn had created with them. And so what you're seeing is, you know, on the nuts and bolts end of it is just like HVX 200 cameras, like not even real HD, like 720p cameras. And like, so you're, you know, those were what we could get for the money we had at the time. And there's no real lighting or anything in those movies. So you're looking at like kind of a bare bones, little bit of an experiment that happened to be a movie. When by the time the experiment was done, there was a feature film, and it was a really good one. And then, so if you kind of fast forward to Touchy Feely or Laggies, the cameras got a little better. You know, Laggies was on an Alexa, and that's a movie making camera. That's a digital camera that one would use for a movie that you would catch in the theater. By, you know, Seamus McGarvey uses those. You know, like people use those cameras all the time, and it's like that's the sort of standard. And you know, some of it is budgetary, and just having Lynn having kind of a bit of a hot streak with a bunch of like, was it like six movies in under a decade, and she like just, people know that if they're gonna endorse those movies, but through money, through gear, through whatever, that the movies are going to get made and they're going to get seen and that they're going to be good. So there's part of it is that just the machinery, like the gear got better, the gear got cheaper, the gear became available to us. Another part of it is that we were able to find a nice balance between the sort of stripped down no crew model of My Effortless Brilliance and the sort of standard indie filmmaking set crew model of having maybe too many people standing around watching actors do their thing. So Seattle's a really wonderful place to make movies, and we have an incredible wealth of people that are not only our friends, but are very, very, very good at their jobs and have found their way into the film industry as a choice. It's Seattle's not an industry town, so it's very, very difficult to find someone up there that was like, oh, like I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I got through high school. My dad was a gaffer. He got me in the Electric Union. Now I'm a gaffer because the money's good. You tend to find people that are, they got out of college. They had a job working mortgages. They had a job selling software. They hated it. They put themselves through a film school and then just jumped into it, and they love their jobs. And so we have a really wonderful, small, tight-knit crew of people that are really good at what they do, and they know what Lynn's trying to get at when it comes time to roll the cameras. So you get all of the bells and whistles and wonderful skill set that comes with like a really seasoned, great crew that know each other and love each other, but they that also know that they're going to go outside and grab a snack for the next hour and a half while we figure out the scenes.
I was going to say, because Lynn's movies have been so improvised or semi-improvised, what is that like as a cinematographer to cover dialogue scenes, or how do you approach that method of filmmaking as opposed to something that's so rigidly scripted?
Yeah, I think there's probably a two-part answer to that. One is a little more vague, but I think the best possible sort of boot camp as a camera person for that would have been all the years I spent shooting dance. Like I had no vocabulary for dance. I have no preconceptions about it. I didn't know how choreography worked. And so when people are like, all right, we're going to do this thing and you're going to shoot it, and it's the first or second time you've seen a piece of choreography, you just kind of have to get it right quickly. So part of that, like the sort of my ignorance going into the dance film world, allowed me to get the chops to like look and react very quickly while still maintaining a shot or coverage that seemed deliberate and hopefully not too sophomoric. And then the second part of that is we learned really early on that like cross shooting and cross covering, for people just kind of jumping in, like it's covering two sides of a conversation, two separate cameras, and learning how to light for two people sitting in a room or on opposite sides of a room and being able to shoot them at the same time so that the sort of standard actor technique of film acting for a single camera didn't apply. People were able to talk over one another. People didn't have to wait for someone to finish delivering a sentence before they could talk so that the audio would be not compromised. And so we knew that, after My Effortless Brilliance and sort of Linda spent some time, in the Joe Swanberg world, and we both have spent time in the Mark Duplass world. We knew that like the positive effect of having two cameras on a scene really allowed, it opened up tons and tons of material to the editor when it came time to improvise, that you could have both sides of a scene and people talking over one another and reacting very honestly and acting very honestly. And rather than giving an editor two single camera setups to have to piece together an entire improvised scene, they would have two simultaneously running camera angles that would encourage an edit to follow the little streams that would come out of improvised material. So it's much easier to find a good 90-second run of a 20-minute improvisational piece where you have coverage on both major actors.
Wow.
That's intense. I was going to ask you earlier about Dogma 95, but now I'm not going to. After you went on that. Yeah, but because Nick brought up an excellent point of the progressive nature of your collaboration with Lynn and how, I don't want this to sound negative when I say the look becomes more refined and polished, because sometimes that can be a bad thing, but I don't think it is for how the collaboration between you two have has transpired over the years. But I can't help but take from the earlier stuff the whole Dogma 95. Not that every rule in that was was followed to a T from Von Trier's manifesto, or whatever you want to call it. But I certainly gathered that, and I mean, I still see elements of that when I watch the newer films that you two have done. I mean, is there any merit to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that the Dogma rules, I mean, they're nothing if not incredibly liberating. You know, they're like the perfect set of creative constrictions. All those rules, all they would really ever do is encourage you to make a film for less, with less. You make a better film with less ingredients, you know. So I do agree that, you know, like, and Lynn will say it too, like, she went back to the Dogma stuff because it was those handheld cameras were faster to cover things with. You needed less people. The cameras could be smaller, with, you know, not lighting scenes. And, you know, using only settings and sets that were readily available and, you know, specifically picked because of their inherent nature and inclusion in the story, like, that, all that stuff worked into Lynn's world. She wrote movies for places that were at our disposal. She wrote movies around real people that we knew because the performances would be better if they were incorporating their own lives into it. So I don't take any kind of offense at that. I 100% agree. Like, that those rules, the Von Trier's rules were, you know, they didn't need to be followed to a T, but they certainly opened doors. They certainly opened doors after, you know, we had made a movie that cost a lot of money for her first feature, and no one had any money, and we still wanted to make movies. You know, it helped that she went out on the road and ran into Joe Swanberg and Mark Duplass, and, you know, as we were doing the festival tours that year, I think LOL might have been touring, like Swanberg's LOL, and he was just getting started, and, like, that guy, he'll tell you, like, he, you know, he wanted to make a feature film, and he had $2,000, so he made a $2,000 feature film. Like, there's nothing more liberating than that. That was impossible when I was in film school. You know, you couldn't even get the film stock, let alone a camera.
Man, some of these names, just in case people don't know, like names like Swanberg and Duplass, I mean, and Lynn, these are the names that really, in my mind, have sort of led the way. You know, I'll say the term, even though that I'm not the biggest fan of it, the mumblecore movement of filmmaking. I've just, you know, I've always thought it was kind of silly or whatever. I never bought into the whole notion of that term, but you know, these voices in cinema have really paved the way for really solid character based smart independent filmmaking with an edge. So I think that it's really a testament to your abilities as well that, you know, these are the names that you've worked with and these are the people that have sort of guided your, you know, career. And then I definitely want to ask you, because just as unique as your collaborations have been with someone like Lynn, how did you get involved working with Guy Maddin, and what is it like to, you know, working with him on the variety of projects that you have? The one I really would like to talk about, because it's the one I know the most, you know, I'm the most versed in, is Keyhole. How did your sort of experience with Guy come about?
Yeah, so you know, when I was working at this film company, this sort of arts experiment, I was lucky enough to just be their cinematographer for everything they did. And the first one of the first things we did, Guy was doing a little, kind of not even a tour. He was stopping in Seattle to show to host a couple of Q&As and show his. It was a feature that was made out of 12 installation pieces that he did for Toronto Film Festival called Cowards Bend the Knee. And it was I think it's a movie that he made about daughters and fathers. And he was coming to the Northwest Film Forum in Seattle to show it. And all of us were really excited that he was coming. And we had extended an invitation to him as this film company to say, hey, while you're in town, if you want to make a short film, we'd love to make one. We've got all the crew that you would want. We've got the resources. If you want to make a short film about anything you want, you can do it. And he kind of thought about it for a second and said, I don't have time to make a short, but I've got a feature. If you want to do a feature, and we were like, done, we'll make this feature. And so he came up with this idea for Brand Upon the Brain, and it was the first sort of big production that the film company did. It was the second feature I had technically shot, but the first one really kind of disappeared and I kind of consider an extension of film school. So it was really like his Brand Upon the Brain was sort of the first feature I ever did, and it was really intimidating. Like as if people know Guy's work, they know it's extremely visual and extremely personal and extremely curated, and it has a very specific tone to it. And the era that I sort of teamed up with him, he had been dabbling a lot with German Expressionism and Russian cinema from the 20s and trying to sort of recreate, I guess I would say he's trying to recreate and embrace the nostalgia for a period of film history that doesn't quite exist. That he could pull from things that were like little bookmarks in film history, but he created his own little melange out of it. So that was my first feature, and like we got along really well. You know, I think we shot for 11 days together, and then by the end of it, he sort of let me just shoot 3 more days without him as a second unit director / DP, and just send him footage when he was back in Winnipeg for the cut. And it was such a nice experience, and
yeah, that's great.
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. Like I remember we had this day where we were shooting on Super 8 and 16mm, and most of the stuff I was doing was Super 8, and I had some ideas about it, but like we really had to like shoot a bunch of Super 8, get it developed, and there weren't even dailies to screen. Our dailies, just to make sure everything was working, were on the second or third day of shooting. Guy and I at lunchtime went into a back room and projected with a Super 8 projector the original footage from the 3 separate cameras we were using onto the wall, just to make sure there weren't hairs in the gate or scratches or anything. And knowing Guy, he would have just embraced them anyway. And luckily, like, everything looked good, but it was just totally nerve-wracking. Like, he'd been making movies for 20 years at that point. And it was just more. I think he'd been making movies for 25 years at that point. And it was just, everything looked good. He felt great about it. And we got along really well. Like he's really funny, and he's kind of ribald, and he's got like an endless supply of really funny, like dirty jokes. And he's got a lot of he's just got a lot of history in like, you know, hockey locker rooms in Canada with dudes. And we get along.
Yeah. He's got the personality to match the eccentric film style.
Yes, 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 yes. And he's got an entire narrative spinning in his head at all times. And he's a very tactile filmmaker in a way that's like, you know, he would operate camera almost all of the time. And anytime I was shooting and he had to explain a shot for more than 30 seconds, I would just hand him the camera. And I mean, he's up, he's down, he's standing, he's like moving all around. He'll talk to actors while the cameras are rolling. And, he doesn't stop moving. It's like very much a tornado. And I liked that. I could embrace that. And it's really fun for me to be around that. It feels more like you're kind of collaborating on something that's like a bit of movie making and a bit of this sort of like choreographed athletic maneuver or something. It's really wonderful. So we kind of kept in touch, and then you know, we did a few shorts in there, and then he got some money together for Keyhole, which was a bit more of a it was his take on Ulysses inside of a haunted house. It takes place in Winnipeg in the 1930s, I think, but it could kind of take place at any point. And because we'd gotten along so well, he flew me up to Winnipeg, and I was there for most of the summer. I can't remember the year now; I'd have to look it up. I think he had gotten a little bit more money. You know, he was sort of kind of coming out of a winning streak critically with a couple of features. He had done My Winnipeg after.
I think that's probably the one that maybe the most people might be familiar with, considering you know, not that his films haven't been well reviewed or critically acclaimed. This one received intense accolades, made numerous film festival rounds. My Winnipeg, great film.
Yeah, it's incredible, and that one I wish I could have shot. Unfortunately, unfortunately for me, that was funded entirely through Canadian doc entities, and it was much easier for him to work with Canadian DPs. Or DOPs, as they call them, north of the border. But when the time came to do Keyhole, Guy had gotten a little bit more money. He was able to get some familiar faces, Jason Patrick and Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah.
And if you look close, you can see Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall. There's a lot of Canadian treasures in there, and then there's a lot of sort of international faces and recognizable people. And that film was great because it was just, I got to work with Guy for a long period of time on his home turf, and Winnipeg is a really special city. It's it's the Canadian Midwest. It's really, people are extremely nice, and it's a Canada that I was not used to. I grew up on the border of Quebec and Ontario, but in northern New York State, and I was sort of, I could kind of like figure out Ontario by the time I was an adult. I could sort of figure out Quebec, but Manitoba is its own beast, and Guy has like some true like Canadian prairie eccentrics that work with him, and it's a really wonderful environment. Nothing is as it seems up there. You think you kind of have it wired, and you're like, okay, it's a big flat plain city that's freezing cold, and it's not that at all. It's something much darker and crazier and more wonderful than you could ever possibly imagine. So it was so nice to be sort of just like just taking in this really absurd theater. Like, it's just people just keep dropping in, and they all have ideas, and they're all like running a million miles an hour, and Guy's like absorbing the best ideas and rejecting tons of them, and like kind of creating his own little universe. And that film was, it was a tough shoot. It was just kind of crazy hours and some big personalities, but just really, really, really fun.
That's awesome. That's very cool. I love these podcasts. I love listening to everybody's stories. These are so fascinating.
Guy is a good one if you can get him on this podcast. Like, he is a great talk. I would say, anything you can do.
We will certainly try.
Yeah. Let me know if I can help.
Yeah, certainly. I wanted to ask you, film versus digital. We love to ask all the cinematographers this.
I'm
filmmakers, actually.
I'm one of the weird ones that loves both. I mean, I absolutely adore film. I grew up on it. It's funny, whenever I go to a theater, you can tell in about 3 seconds the kind of projection you're going to be in for. The moment the first green band for the first, general audience accepted trailer comes up, you can tell what's projecting on film and what's projecting on digital. You can look at the edges of the letters. And I think just being, I'm 38 now, and just being the age that I am, I just grew up on film. So that feels comforting. That feels right. That feels like cinema to me. I can tell the sort of organic grain and the texture of it. And there's a timelessness to it that I sort of felt when I was younger, and then became a very specific feeling of timelessness once I started cutting negative as like a professional right out of college. I just knew that well-preserved negative would just last for forever. And let's see, hard drives go down all the time. You know, people trying to keep digital assets are just like constantly upgrading. And like, how many people are you guys going to talk to in the next year that have entire feature film assets on digital hard drives that are, can't work with their new Thunderbolt laptop?
Right.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's like these, like, I'm a big Herzog fan, and he places a lot of importance on like the images that people use to reflect their experience in the universe. And a lot of those images are conveyed through cinema. And if they're not archivable, what's going to be left, if you're so it's hard to fully embrace digital, but it's also, I can't naysay it because it makes things possible. And it kind of comes back to what you were saying about Dogma 95, like those, because those films were digital, they got made, and they got made,
right,
with a sense of urgency, and they're wonderful. And there's, I could never say like, I'm going to be a purist and only shoot film, because that would never work. I haven't shot a feature on film in years, and I would do it in a second, but no one calls for that. Like, I love digital because it makes things possible.
Right. It seems like the big filmmakers that can beat the drum around film are essentially the only ones left with enough clout to make it, like Christopher Nolan, Tarantino, people like that are the only ones. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, like, everybody's excited because, Tarantino's got a 70mm film coming out. Like,
God, awesome. I just saw the new Hateful Eight poster, and it even says that on the poster.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's great, and I can't wait to see it. And
I know.
We have a Cinerama in Seattle. I'll be first in line. I can't wait. It's going
to
be great.
Yeah, I'm dragging my mom to go see that on Christmas. I mean, I ruined Christmas a couple years ago with Django Unchained, so why not do it again?
Yeah, yeah. Keep up the winning streak. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's such a hard thing. It's like I can't really come down on either side. It's like, I love making movies, so I'm going to shoot digital. I love making movies with Lynn Shelton. We're going to shoot digital for a little while. Like, I love shooting film, and as soon as the opportunity comes up, I'll do it. But there's a lot of things that I work on that film would be prohibitive, not cost prohibitive, but just creatively not the right tool. It's hard to improvise a 40-minute take between two people on two cameras.
Film.
A 1,000-foot mag, can't do it.
Well, I want to ask definitely because you had a chance to shoot, if I'm not mistaken, if not the whole first season, but a vast majority of the first season of Married on FX.
Yes, I did the entire first season.
And for those of you who don't know, this is an extremely funny show on FX, a satirical comedy with Judy Greer, who I'm just I've been in love with forever. I think she's terrific. And Nat Faxon, they play this this sardonic sort of bitter but still in love couple who love to peck each other down, and they've got kids and they're trying to figure it all out, and they've got friends and everybody's screwed up and it's hysterical. What was it like forging a relationship with a TV family over the course of a season, and what was it like to sort of tell a complete story? Because, you know, now television is moving in such a unique way. You know, we just chatted with Nigel Bluck, who shot True Detective and season two. And, you know, he had a similar, you know, chance to work on a show in its entirety for an entire season. And, you know, this sort of seems to be the new mold. Get, you know, a director, a cinematographer, production designers, you know, key craft contributors to stick it out and work, you know, sort of like a mini movie, but in television. What was it like working on Married?
Yeah, I mean, Married was incredible. You know, the guys had called to do the pilot. Sal Levin and Andrew Gerlin were the showrunners. Andrew Gerlin's the sort of main showrunner. Sal Levin, he write all the episodes, and they've just been working together for forever. They had called to do the pilot, and I wasn't available. I think I was maybe shooting the first season of Review at the time, and so they did a pilot. They had about a year go by that they were greenlit for the series. The call sort of came through to do it. And, you know, then we were finally about to get on the phone, and I remember just doing a quick Google search to see what else they had worked on. And I got really, really excited because they were the technical crew on a couple of Todd Phillips' early documentaries. They worked on, Hated, the G.G. Allen doc, and they worked on, Frat House, which is very difficult to find, but is amazing.
Is it still on YouTube? It was on YouTube for the longest time.
If you look up Frat House, Todd Phillips Frat House. So they came out of documentaries that were special, you know, special in that they were antagonistic, but not in a youthful kind of petulant way. And they were getting at deeper stories that were really tricky and weird to tell.
He has a sense of the transgressive, Todd Phillips, which I've always liked.
Yes, and these guys were his right-hand guys, and so they had worked on that stuff, and then they had kind of branched off into their own movies, and so I was really excited, and we got on the phone, and I just remember we were sort of talking about things, and they were like, we love Lynn Shelton, and I was like, you guys don't understand, I got through college watching bootleg copies of Frat House, and I grew up, and my friends and I had to juggle around a copy of Hated because some of our moms didn't want us to have it, and they were just kind of like, what's wrong with you? watching those movies. And so we kind of got along that way. And they loved Lynn Shelton, and they knew they had a vision for the show, and they had an idea for the texture of it. And it's they wanted a show that much in the world of Lynn needed to be approachable, needed to feel like the people you knew next door, needed to feel as far as possible from a sitcom. It needed to feel like an independent movie to them, and it needed to feel honest. And they knew that they wanted characters that were approachable and that were recognizable, and that on a very base sensory level, you would watch a story about people that were very familiar, start in a world that you knew, and by the end of an episode, just have all of this craziness piled upon them and have it be entirely believable. You know, that we couldn't have... The sense of humor could not come from stretching the boundaries outside the reality of the show. And that reality of the show had to be grounded and anchored in everyday life. And again, they kind of on their own came into a very similar territory as Lynn, where they wanted something cinematic, but it needed to feel real. So it was just on the beautiful side of everyday reality.
And this was a, you know, Married's a scripted show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you were able to take your loose style, but apply it to a more rigidly constructed narrative, which must have been different for you in that sense.
Yeah, it was. I mean, again, it's sort of like I remember getting a little like, okay, this is a little bit bigger. Like, it's an FX show. Like, more people will probably see the opening of this than anything I've worked on up to this point. You know, I remember being like, kind of like, oh my God, you know, just TV, the stakes are, if you have a tendency to internalize, your own criticisms about your work, TV is really pretty daunting because so many people see it right away. There's no escaping it. And so if you blow it, you blow it. And if it's great, it's great. And, it's kind of an equalizer that way, I guess. But, I don't know. I knew that they wanted this kind of beautiful feeling, and that I'd come out of, you know, creating worlds that were cinematic but real, and cinematic and grounded in reality. And I knew that we were going to go with two cameras, and I knew I could do that. I knew at this point where I'd done season one of that, I was like at least 8 or 9 years into the world of cross-covering scenes and figuring out how to best shoot improvised scenes between four people at a table. And I knew what battles to fight where, you know, if it's very, very difficult to light both sides of a room well if you're shooting them at the same time. And there's you know, you get 100% of awesomeness in any camera shot, you know. Like, you can get it to 100% and it'll be fantastic. And if you have two camera angles, you could still only have that 100%. And, like, you can get both of them to 100%, but probably what's going to happen is they're both going to be about an 85, maybe an 88. And, like, you got to find the ways to sort of sacrifice the look in service of the performance. And I'd been doing that for so long, like juggling that with Duplass and juggling that with Lynn and, you know, kind of figuring out, like, you know, does this scene need to look like an A+, or does this scene need to look like an A- with a triple plus performances that everybody's going to remember forever? And so that, like, having that background with Lynn and Mark, I felt confident knowing which battles to pick with the lighting and which battles to pick with specific camera placement, and when we were going to be painted in the corner, with how well we could make two people look when they're jammed in the corner of a bar and we have to shoot both sides at once. So there's, you know, there was some familiar territory with it, and it was a scripted show, but those guys had a very improvisational approach to it. And as soon as we got the scene that was on paper, they started opening it up. And because we had...
Yeah, I'd have to imagine with Faxon and with Greer and with, you know, with the rest of the cast. I mean, everybody in the, you know, Riser and Jenny Slate, who I think is just a pisser.
Yeah,
she's hysterical. And, you know, my feeling is just, when you have all these great people, how impossible is it not for, once you've gotten what's on the page, how impossible is it not to let them just do 10 different takes of the same scene, but, you know, on their own, because the opportunity just would probably seem limitless when you have those kind of people you're working with.
That's exactly it. I mean, we just, you know, we would get the scene pretty quickly. Those guys they're all stellar, technically stellar actors, but they're all technically stellar improvisers. And I mean, like,
I've been
loving told me, like,
Riser on there.
Oh God, Riser's the best. He's in Red Oaks as well, and we can talk about that in a bit. But that guy's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, Nat Paxton told me, like, partway through through the show, he told me that he had a troop at the Groundlings. He had a group at the Groundlings. It was a 4-person group, and the three people whose names I remember were Nat Paxton, Dax Shepard, and Melissa McCarthy, all on stage at once. Like, that's where he comes from. Like, those guys it's crazy. Like, you know, those guys they're all like that. Like, Judy's been working for forever. She's hilarious. I mean, she spends her time with Adam Reed, and, like, those are like heavy hitter comedians, you know? And so,
I love that Nat is a co-writer on stuff like The Descendants, you know?
Yeah.
Like that,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's a terrific thing. You know that the guy's talented. It's like, what could you not get away with, you know, when you're working with those people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like, all of them have their own things going. They're all wonderful writers. But yeah, it was, you know, we would always tear open a scene and let them go at it. You know, I think the days ran long quite a bit because the improvs were so good. And to the credit of Sal and Andrew, the showrunners, it was like, once we sort of had it up on its feet, all they wanted were variations in the camera work. All they wanted were, they wanted us to be able to capture the comedy without jumping the jokes, which is a very, like, zen kind of camera operation. Like, you really have to understand what makes the delivery of a joke funny, so you don't ruin it by like hitting the zoom at the wrong time, or like panning off of someone before the reaction is correct. And it's a very specific, tricky thing. And luckily I was on the B camera, and then the A camera operator was Mark Carter, who I'd worked with quite a bit on Review with Comedy Central, which has a very similar kind of approach to the depiction of comedy and the delivery of jokes. And they were, to Sal and Andrew's credit, not only were they game to let really wonderful improvisers go into improv world on their scripts that they'd worked very specifically on, but they encouraged us on the camera front to play around and make the show feel like we were just capturing reality that happened to be hilarious, and it happened to be over the top by the time 22 minutes of comedic situations have overlapped on themselves and sent things into a ridiculous territory, you know?
Right. So Red Oaks.
Yeah.
What's going on with that? What can you say?
Oh, my God.
The pilot's out on Amazon. I have Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. I can't wait.
If you watch that pilot, it is beautifully shot by Tim Orr, who was not available for the show.
Tim's terrific.
Tim's amazing. Tim is one of my heroes, and he is also a very, very sweet guy, and he's great. He was extremely generous when I ended up jumping on the show. He shared quite a bit of his working methods, and it just anything you could possibly ask for from a collaborator. He's fantastic.
He's Gordon Green's guy, right?
He is. Yeah, he shot all of David's movies. Those guys went to NCSA together, North Carolina School of the Arts. They were, I think David probably graduated film school a year or two before me. And I met David like years ago. I was a projectionist for the Olympia Film Society. And during the Olympia Film Festival, he came through and showed, I remember he showed George Washington. I remember sitting there watching and being like, fuck yes, this is amazing. Like just so completely enamored. And I love Malick, like who doesn't, but like he clearly knew the Malick world. He knew that kind of tone poem. He knew how to juggle the poetics of voiceover and visuals and music in a 90-minute movie that doesn't seem long. And it doesn't seem, it just, everything worked in that movie. And I remember like talking to him at the like sort of reception area after his Q&A and being like, we just went off about Terrence Malick, and he pulled out an old passport photograph of Terrence Malick from his wallet. And I was like, this is the coolest guy I've ever met. This is amazing. like, this is incredible. So, we kind of stayed in touch a little bit over the years, and he had formed Rough House Productions, and they had made some of the early Jody Hill stuff like Foot Fist Way. And House, maybe they went on to, I don't know if they worked with HBO when they did Eastbound and Down, but it was the guys who made Eastbound. And they, a mutual friend, Todd Rohal, is the director, and those guys produced a movie I did with Todd called The Catechism Cataclysm. So like David and I had sort of been around each other a little bit, and then randomly we were at South by Southwest and had just come out of a movie, and we're talking, and he was asking what I was up to, and I said, oh, I've been doing a bunch of TV stuff and just looking around for the next project. And he's like, oh, well, let's get in touch. I think I might have something. And that turned out to be Red Oaks, because Tim wasn't available. But you can watch the pilot online, and Tim shot that. He did a really beautiful job.
The pilot is available right now to see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, on Amazon.
Amazon Prime, but it's free. It's a free, you can watch it for free on Amazon Prime. Just type in Red Oaks, two separate words, REDOAKS. It takes place in 1985. In New Jersey, and it's about a guy who's between school years at NYU, and he's a sort of a commuter student to NYU from a suburb of New Jersey, and he ends up taking a job as an assistant tennis pro at a really shishy country club in North Jersey. And the guy's pitched it to me as sort of a little bit of The Graduate and a little bit of Caddyshack.
I love it already.
It's awesome. And let's see, I can list off some of the cast just to whet the appetite. It's Craig Roberts from Richard Ayoade's film Submarine. He's a Welsh actor.
Yes, yeah, very funny movie.
He's fantastic. Paul Reiser. Let's see here.
I love how Paul Reiser's coming back.
He's the best.
Yes.
Whiplash, he's going to be in Concussion. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to see him come back.
Yeah, yeah. He is. This is a role he was meant for. He's in it. Jennifer Grey. Gina Gershon, Richard Mazur.
Okay.
Yeah,
and,
it's good.
And it sounds like yet another project from David Gordon Green that is mixing tones, and it's going to be unclassifiable. I love the eclecticism of his career. You cannot pin that guy down whatsoever. He busts out with George Washington and All the Real Girls, and then does something like, you know, Your Highness and Pineapple Express, and then comes back with the Snow Angels. And he's just in, you know, Eastbound and Down. The sense of humor that the man has is so unique. It strikes me as probably another show where, you know, all of the elements are going to produce something creative and unique, is at least what it sounds like.
It is. Yeah. It's very funny, and it's very sad, and it's very sweet. And it's the episodes build on each other. So by the time we finished our shooting, I was like, wow, we have like a 3-hour movie. This isn't a bunch of episodes that are, you know, standalone things. This is like it all builds, and it all has through lines, and the characters all kind of end up at a much different place than where they begin. And the best part about it was that David directed the pilot and the second episode and the finale, but our other directors were Hal Hartley, Amy Heckerling, Nisha Ganatra,
wow,
and Andy Fleming. It's just
awesome. Oh,
you know,
Andy Fleming.
Yeah, he's
done very underrated comedies there.
And The Craft and Dick. And, like, that guy's amazing.
Yep. Dick is hysterical. It's such a funny movie. And correct me if I'm wrong, Steven Soderbergh had some involvement?
Yeah, executive producers were Steven Soderbergh, David Gordon Green, and then the showrunners were Greg Jacobs, who just made Magic Mike XXL.
He's
Soderbergh's guy. They've done The Nick. He's produced probably the last 20 years worth of Soderbergh's movies.
Yeah.
And he's done other stuff, too, outside of that. Like, he did Edge of Tomorrow, that awesome Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt movie that came out last year. It's like, awesome. That guy's fantastic. And then Joe Gangemi is one of his writers, and those guys have done a bunch of movies together. Joe's a novelist. And it's the pedigree of the show is really great, and the we got really lucky, man. It was a great summer.
Can you explain the model? So like the pilot is available on Amazon, and you've completed photography on how many episodes?
We did 10 episodes total. The first episode would be the pilot, and then I shot episodes 2 through 10 this summer. So we did 9 of them over the last over the last 9 weeks. We just wrapped up a week ago.
And how does it work in terms of when they will release more episodes, or how does it, you know, because Amazon's now getting original content for people who don't know. I mean, most people do probably, but.
So if you sign up for Amazon Prime and you pay, I don't know how much it is a year, but you get free rapid delivery. And more importantly, you get to watch things like Transparent and Mozart in the Jungle. And Amazon, like Netflix, is creating its own content, and they're trying to market themselves as a place that is director friendly and auteur friendly, and they want people to make interesting stuff. And the Red Oaks has found a home with them. And the plan, as I know it, is to drop all of the episodes at once in October. So they're fever pitch right now.
Awesome.
They're going crazy. Like, I just did the first round of color notes on the 6th of 10 episodes.
Wow.
Fast. Yeah.
And anything on the feature horizon that you want to discuss? I know that based on the IMDb that there's a couple of films that are going to come out later this year or have in limited. So
I'm trying to think here. I have a feeling I guess I can talk about it. They're gunning probably for some sort of a festival intro to the world, but I did a feature called MF last winter. The director and writer is Robert Schwartzman of the Schwartzman Coppola family. His mother's Talia Shire, and Jason Schwartzman's brother. He's a musician, and he made his first feature, which I'm really excited about. It's going to be really good. It's got Amy Landecker from Transparent, and she was on Louie. She did this season of Married.
Yeah.
Wonderful. It's going to be really good. So I think they're pushing for some sort of a festival release. So I think they're still in post-production now. And then in very, very early pre-production on the feature called Cold November, that's the second in a trilogy of a filmmaker by the name of Carl Jacobs, He's making a trilogy in his hometown of Hibbing, Minnesota. And kind of it's a little bit about life in Hibbing. I can't talk too much about it yet, but it'll be a follow-up to a feature we did called Polywogs that came out a few years ago and did the festival route.
Wow. Awesome, man. Yeah. That's awesome. It sounds like you've been a pretty busy dude.
Yeah.
Well, I know you've been a busy dude. Jeez, looking at your – anybody who's listening to this – needs to look at Ben's IMDb page. Holy fuck.
Well, thanks, man. I'm taking my first break in a while. I'm actually, like, taking a vacation.
It begs the question of, do you sleep? So it's amazing. And you know, and one of the other things, too, is that you've done documentaries and short films. I mean, there really doesn't seem to be a medium that you haven't touched. Are you a fan of working in the doc realm and the short film world?
Yeah, I mean, I love them. I just love working. Like, I love collaborating. I love, like, I feel at my best when I'm around people that love what they do and feel empowered to do it well. And we're trying to figure out, of all the great ideas everyone in the room is coming up with, which one is the best for the movie we're making right now. Like, that's ideal living to me. So, you know, I might not sleep that much when I'm really working, but it's because I love it and I want it to be good. And so it's,
you have all these great opportunities, and while you're, you know, you're young, you know, take it while you can. I just turned 35. So, you know, if you're 38,
just turned 30.
Yeah.
Nice.
So we're all in the same, you know, the same realm. We're young enough, but you know, it's one of those things.
And we went to film school too.
Yes.
Yes, so. That is true. That is true. But yeah, it seems that you've been able to take some really excellent opportunities to full advantage. So just wanted to say thank you very much for, you know, spending time with us and chatting with us about, you know, your career and, you know, about what drives you as a cinematographer. And, you know, we'd love to have you come back on the show when you've got, you know, new projects, or even if you just want to come on and chat about one of your favorite movies. You know, we always like to ask people what they like, you know, what's a couple movies that we might, you know, find you watching, you know, on a Friday or Saturday night if you're not working.
Let me think here. I've got a lot of favorites lately.
Your favorite movie, just something that you like.
I'm trying to think of what I watched recently. Last night I just rewatched Serpico.
Yes.
I'm on a Netflix kick because I'm at our, like, family cabin in northern New York right now. So I'm on Netflix. I don't have any DVDs here. But I just rewatched that. And, like, that era, I'm obsessed with my brain. I always freeze. It happens to all my film friends that people ask, and they The Last Detail. Hal Ashby, The Last Detail.
Oh, really, man, obsessed. That's a goodie.
Yeah. And, like, that was a big, we talked about that a lot during Red Oaks. Like, Greg Jacobs and I really, like, went off on a daily basis about how awesome The Last Detail is. And like that. If I could have been making movies at any era, it would have been that sort of Robert Evans 70s, like, anywhere from like Rosemary's Baby through First Blood.
That's the common time frame between all of our guests and the stuff Nick and I like, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very cool.
It's just that there's something reactionary, and, you know, there's something that's you know, not like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and it's something that's not quite Pulp Fiction yet, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
For sure, man.
Yeah, well, again, thank you very much. And
thank you, guys. This is awesome. Thanks so much. This is really sweet.
Yeah, man. And seriously, though, anytime you want to come back on, open invitation.
Oh, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
An open invitation. Talk about The Last Detail. Talk about Serpico.
Excellent. Yes, we'll talk about growing mustaches together and becoming men in our 40s.
I know. For sure. I have to shave mine off for a wedding I'm going to be in.
Oh, boo.
I'm upset
that's
about
a friend.
It.
That's a good friend.
I know. Yeah, I know. So.
He's doing him a solid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do the peanut butter solution.
And it's not even him. He doesn't care. It's his fiance. But, I mean, she's cool. So, like, whatever. I may be an asshole, but I told Nick, like, I'm not going to be the asshole that ruins the wedding photos with, like, my 70s mustache.
Yeah. You can be the asshole that was your gift to them.
Exactly. Exactly, man.
Oh.
All right. Well, right on. This was an excellent chat.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great. Thanks for making time and having me on, and I look forward to the next
Absolutely.
One.
For sure.
Right, take care.